Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hello, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in. I'm Joe McCormick.
And I'm Lauren Volkebaum.
And our regular host, Jonathan Strickland, is not with us today. He is out prowling the grounds of CES, or he might actually be on an airplane at the moment, coming back home.
Resting from his journalistic predatory technology.
Right. It is well-deserved rest.
Yes.
I think he has been working his little heart out there.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, today we're joined by a special guest co-host,
yes.
Our friend and co-worker, Christian. Christian, introduce yourself.
Hey guys, I'm Christian Sager. I'm a writer and host here at How Stuff Works. I started out working on Stuff of Genius, one of our shows, and am currently a writer with these guys on both Brain Stuff and What the Stuff.
Those are two of our video shows.
Video shows.
It is a distinct pleasure to have you with us today, Christian.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Especially since we're going to be talking about various features of destruction and decay.
And that's really what we think about when we think of you.
It's what I associate mostly with your face.
It makes sense. Yeah.
Given
the pockmarks and the age.
Oh, that was
not your face as a decaying thing, but like
my soul.
Next to those concepts, sort of in the dictionary, there's the idea of Christian Sager.
That's accurate.
You are pretty metal, so.
I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I'm probably the most metal person at How Stuff Works.
Well, we are glad that we could have you here to talk about ruins and the future of ruins.
Right, ruins. I mean, usually we don't get to talk about ruins on a podcast about the future because ruins are something we associate with the past.
Mm-hmm.
But since we are talking about ruins, I thought it would be the only occasion I ever get to read Percy Bysshe Shelley on the Forward Thinking podcast. So we will begin with a short reading of Ozymandias by P.B. Shelley.
Do it.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. On the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
Yeesh.
Nicely done.
Yeah, thank you for that depressing
you just
introduction.
Just won the poetry slam. And I also, if Shelley was alive today, he would totally be the singer in a black metal band.
I know. It is very black metal. It's very serious and death and destruction and time washes everything away. But it's also got a kind of great cheesy dust in the wind quality to it.
Yeah.
So, yes, part black metal, part Kansas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I like the Schadenfreude to it, too. Like, it's very much like sucka. Look at that guy.
Well, I like how the line, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, takes on an ironic double meaning. I believe in the way the king, I think he's referring to the Egyptian king Ramses II, also known as Ozymandias.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying to the other kings, like, look at this stuff I've built.
It's really great stuff.
Yeah, you can't build anything like this. You should despair. But really, to the reader, it starts to take on the idea of time. We're all going to look on his works in despair because this happens to all of us. Everybody ends
even
up
the greatest
in the,
of us fall to dust.
Yeah, the lone and level sands where we get brought down by time. Now, this may sound like kind of a bleak place to begin a podcast about the future. And so it's not going to be all death and destruction. We wanted to look at the physical features of civilization and imagine what they're going to look like in the future. What will the cities of today look like in 500 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years from the present? What will future humans see if they visit the ruins that are to them what the ruins of ancient Rome are to us?
Yeah. And so how would you like to start with that, Joe?
First, let's limit the scope a little bit of what we're talking about here. Like, let's put out some definitions.
Okay, so if we're going to try to imagine the future ruins of modern civilization, we should sort of define our terms. And one of the first things I want to get out of the way is the definition of civilization, because sometimes the word civilization can take on a value judgment connotation, like a thing that is civilized mm-hmm. is good. A thing that's uncivilized is like impolite or improper. You know, you'd say, oh, my friend Johnny, he's always urinating in public. That's uncivilized behavior.
Mm-hmm. Or, oh, she doesn't serve that kind of tea in her home. How uncivilized.
Right, right.
Or, as Henry Rollins has been known to say, you're so civilized, you get brutalized.
Yes. Good examples all.
That is not at all the way we mean the word here. We mean civilization more in the historical or archaeological sense, which has a lot of connotations, but overall denotes a settled lifestyle in densely populated urban areas, or in a word, cities, city life. And in fact, the English word city and civilization, I think, both have their root in the same Latin terms, like civitatem or civitas, which, from what I can tell, it has kind of an abstract and complex definition, but it has to do with being a citizen or the citizenry. And what does that have to do with ruins? Well, most, though certainly not all, ruins as we experience them today come from these larger civilizations, as opposed to the less populous and less civilized in this sense cultures that don't build large monuments.
Or large buildings, you know, right.
Certainly, yeah.
Functional or artistic, either one. What we really mean is that it's easier for people to kind of trip across a 450-foot tall pyramid than even very complex systems of roads or irrigation that might be buried under a few layers of sediment in a desert somewhere.
Sure.
And we are getting better at the latter, by the way, and there's some really interesting research going into that through like new satellite imaging techniques and other technologies, but that is a subject for an entirely different podcast.
Yeah, that's interesting that it brings up the issue of that there's sort of a differential survival rate for different physical remnants of mm-hmm. society. So you have some things that we build in our cities that are still easily visible hundreds of years in the future, and other things that you might be able to find evidence of if you're really looking for it, but the average person wouldn't necessarily notice it.
Yeah.
Depending on the maintenance of those artifacts.
On the maintenance and also on just the climate and other surroundings. But we will get into those in a minute.
Let's define what ruins are the same way we defined what civilization is.
That's a good plan.
Yeah, there are actually a lot of interesting theories of ruins, of, you know, ruination theory. That'd be a wonderful, like, sub-specialization that you could study.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could say I was an expert on ruination. I'm not, though. If I could go back and start my education over, I might go down that path.
Yeah.
But anyway, in the general sense, ruins are sort of what's left behind when human-made structures are partially destroyed or they just fall out of the cycle of use and maintenance. So if a building is very old, but you're still using it daily and living and working and shopping in it, and you're making repairs, fixing cracks, maybe replacing parts of it, you probably wouldn't call that an example of ruins, even if it's very old.
Yeah.
On the other hand, ruins tend to be things that people might visit, but they don't remain in use and kept up through maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this piece that I came across when we were doing our research, which was in National Geographic, and they did a trio of blog posts called A Dialogue of Civilizations Conference. It was in Guatemala in 2013. So apparently it was like their notes based on the conference.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a whole section that was all about the ancient past as a window to the future, looking at ruins and thinking about this very concept. And one of the things that they came up with in that was that they think of ruins as being emblems of our vanity.
Huh.
That they are basically not just that, but that they are also signs of whatever civilization they represent, part of their identity or their ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to keep in mind, as we're talking about ruins today, like, or the ruins of the future in particular, how are they emblematic of our vanity as a culture or our particular ideologies?
Right. You can feel almost the desire to be worshipped emanating from many of the monuments and ruins of old. You see, like, the pyramids of Giza. At least for me, when I look at something like that, it radiates this sense of somebody wanting to be seen as powerful.
Mm-hmm. It's the idea of immortality through an artifact
through
that's
construction.
Going to last longer than you will, or even your legacy.
Yeah, and so whatever it is that's so important to you that you want to make it big enough to last.
So if you think about the modern day equivalent of something like a pyramid or the Arc de Triomphe, or something that shows off the power, the splendor, the glory of the civilization, what is that today?
Well, I mean, just off the top of my head, we are in Atlanta right now, and looking out the window, what I see are skyscrapers and malls mm-hmm. and public transportation hubs, a lot of cars, a lot of highways. These are the things that we seem to venerate nowadays. They're not necessarily built to last in the way that the pyramids were.
Right.
Maybe, like, for Atlanta in particular, one of the things I always think about is the stuff that they built downtown when the Olympics were here in the 90s. Mm. So there's stuff like that that is probably meant to last. But what else? What do you guys think?
You know, what I think of is I think of public use areas like sports stadiums.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And things like that. Those to me shout a kind of – and I don't know if the way in which they're physically constructed means they'll actually last longer than any other type of building. They might not, but they at least speak to me like this is a it seems to embody values and to scream power projection.
They're the Colosseum of our time.
Yeah. I mean, also very large. Like, we've got a Six Flags just outside of Atlanta here.
I'm not sure. Ruins of roller coasters.
They're beautiful. I don't know if you've ever seen any of the images from Coney Island, but
I have. I've been to Coney Island.
Uh-huh.
And
haunted.
So the Cyclone is the world's, maybe the world, it might just be the United States' most oldest roller coaster. And most oldest, you know.
Yeah. No, that's a scientific term, yes.
Yeah. It's terrifying. I've ridden on it. It's just wood and nails.
Well, how do you ride on it now? They just put you in a paper bag and push you down the top hill?
Yeah.
Well, they strap wheels to your arms and legs.
It's a little bit bumpy, but yeah.
No, it's really scary.
Another thing that seems to be suggested by the idea of ruins is something about decline, because with lots of the structures we have, I mean, on their own, they could fall into disrepair and become ruins, but we keep them up.
Mm-hmm.
So what leads to people not being able to keep up their structures?
Well, it assumes, I think, like one of two things probably that we can boil it down to, that there is either the civilization has either gotten to a point where it's mismanaging its structures so much that it's neglecting them,
mm-hmm.
Or there is some kind of external force that has come in and has done damage to it, like in war, for instance.
And perhaps there's been some kind of event that has forced the population to move to a new area, something climate related, perhaps.
Sure. Yeah. That's the other thing that sort of touches on what I wanted to add to complicate this. I don't think it's necessarily always mismanagement, though that can be part of it, because there can also be just the fact that people don't care about certain things
wholesale
anymore.
Up and leaving the stuff
behind. Or perhaps, for example, when coal production fell to oil production, a lot of places were kind of abandoned because those factories were not, or those mining towns were not necessary anymore.
Are we going to jump ahead? Because one of these places that we were going to talk about is exactly that.
No, we'll save it for.
We'll save it.
Minutes.
Yeah, we can reference back in a second.
Spoilers: we're going to talk about coal.
Just one more distinction that might be interesting is the difference between what we would often call ruins and then something more like monuments. And they can sort of bleed together, but I just wanted to think about the fact that you wouldn't always look at something like the pyramids of Giza and call that ruins.
Oh, right, because nobody lived there.
Right. Well, I mean, people might have camped out there. I don't know. But
well, sure.
But like, it's generally meant as like a thing to behold.
What
not
about
so much...
some of these other ones that are, like, we think of as wonders of the world? So the pyramid is one of them, right? What about like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon?
Well, as far the funny thing about that is, I think it's disputed whether the Hanging Gardens of Babylon actually existed, from what I recall.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are plenty of monuments and things like you could look at like Mount Rushmore or things like that. If after a long time Mount Rushmore becomes sort of eroded and it's not maintained, would you call that a ruin?
I don't know.
But you'd call Machu Picchu a ruin, right?
Certainly, yeah.
Sure. Or if for some reason everyone had to flee Paris and Notre Dame was still standing, you could call that a ruin.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly what the dividing line is there, but I think today we want to talk about both. I mean, we want to talk about monuments and the things you'd more traditionally call ruins.
Mm-hmm.
The structures we build that without maintenance can fall into disrepair.
Yes, although it is certainly anthropologically interesting that these days some of our largest and most impressive structures are not something of religious and cultural significance like the pyramids, but rather something of practical cultural significance like the Hoover Dam.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's true. Right. Like also like the Golden Gate Bridge, that's probably one of the things that will, although we'll talk about this later, how long bridges will last after humans are stopped taking care of them. But that's probably something that people would look back on as being a ruin or a relic of humanity.
Yeah. And then there are, of course, structures that are not really lived in spaces, but they're also not really monuments of symbolic significance, or at least not entirely that. They have some kind of practical use, like, say, the Roman aqueducts or the Great Wall of China. I think, Christian, you've actually been to the Great Wall of China, haven't you?
Yeah, it was a long time ago, over 20 years ago. But I spent some time in Beijing when I was younger. And the Great Wall is fascinating because it was essentially designed as like a defense mechanism against different invaders.
Heard it didn't work very well.
Right. Well, and then, it was multiple walls that over the course of various empires were redesigned and linked up together, et cetera, et cetera. But, it's been neglected for over 300 years now, and a lot of it's in disrepair. However, at the same time, because it is, I don't know necessarily that it's a ruin, but because it's a monument, it's one of those things that is a tourist attraction as well. And the tourism industry that comes to the Great Wall of China helps in the deterioration of it. I myself, 20 years ago, when I was but a boy, carved my initials in the Great Wall of China,
oh,
for instance.
No.
Classy. Yeah.
It's not the kind of decision I would make today.
Well, that's good to hear. But
I probably would have done something like that when I was a kid.
I was 37.
Boys are... What's wrong with us?
We all want to leave our mark, which is really what all of this podcast is about. though I would argue that stuff like tourism, although it does degrade these structures at a certain point just through normal wear and tear, and in addition to things like vandalism, you also wind up having governments looking at these structures as being a useful monetary agent, and therefore having making the decision to restore and repair them.
Yeah. Right, or to at least protect them.
Yes, yes.
To make it a crime to do what Christian did.
And also, and the funds from the tourism industry would probably go into their restoration, whereas if people weren't visiting it, there wouldn't be
that fund. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's transition from thinking about these ancient to modern ruins to thinking about modern ruins that got their ruination started really recently.
Yeah, because there are a few places on this planet, as populated as it tends to be, that we can call ruins, like right now, today, that were created less than a century ago.
Okay, and I want to start with one that if you've never looked at pictures of Pripyat, Ukraine, go pause this and go Google it right now.
That's the Chernobyl site.
Yes. Okay, are you back? So Pripyat, Ukraine was a city that was evacuated due to the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster in 1986 when they had a major meltdown and lots of dangerous radiation was released. They had to abandon the area and it has been uninhabited by humans ever since. So that's been like 29 years now, almost 30 years.
Yeah, we're closing in on the 30-year mark.
So what happens in a place like that where there's been nobody to keep up the repair, the maintenance, the weeding, the
right.
All the things we need to do to keep a city functioning like it normally does.
I think what happened? The things that's fascinating about that, from what I read in the research, is that despite the nuclear incident, that there is still pervasive plant life there that is growing through the structures and breaking them apart.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. So we should think about this place as a complete dead zone. It's been tainted by nuclear radiation. This should be just a poisoned place that's become like the moon. Or at least we would imagine that. But then when you actually look at it, it's almost like a nature preserve now.
Yeah.
They report that lots of species have bounced back there.
Right. Like, one of the things that I was reading was that you wouldn't normally see, like, particular species of wolves in the civilized, still populated areas around there, but that they're very prevalent within the ruins of this town.
That's funny. It's like our presence is more poisonous than a radiation leak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, certainly to lots of parts of nature. But humans are certainly not going to go back in there anytime particularly soon. You can contrast that with the kind of conditions that you see in other places, like, for example, Hashima Island, a.k.a. Gunkanjima, which is an island off of Japan that was kind of famously used as a set piece for the most recent James Bond movie, Skyfall.
It was that creepy abandoned city where the bad guy's hanging out.
Yeah, yeah.
Javier Bardem gets all up on Daniel Craig in one of the buildings.
Yeah, yeah, and what's fascinating about it in the real world, not in the film, is that, spoilers, here we go, it was a coal mining production facility. So this island was populated largely by Korean forced laborers.
Yeah, Korean and Chinese forced laborers.
Yeah.
And this was going on largely, I believe, in the 1920s through the 50s. I think it was shut down circa 1950 to 59.
Yeah, I think that the last people left the island in the early 70s, I read, because petroleum had basically taken over the industry from coal, and there was no longer a need for them to run the island the way they were.
So what do the structures actually look like now?
Well, all the glass is gone. The concrete is kind of starting to erode. All of the wooden bits that were on the outsides of the structures forming and any kind of like latticework or porches or things like that have all fallen to the ground. It's desolate.
It's also super dangerous from what I was reading.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Like Skyfall, they actually only used exterior shots for the stuff that they shot there because the production crew deemed it too dangerous to shoot on the island.
Yeah, certainly with principal actors. Yeah, they recreated.
Yeah.
Look, we're
Daniel Craig
guys
and Javier
Bardem.
They can't go to this island. But, you know, extras, yeah, we can probably get them there.
They recreated one of the courtyards on the Pinewood Studios sets out in the UK in order to film the scenes that you see of them standing there. So, Hollywood magic, y'all.
Back to this island.
Yeah. There's
this really cool thing I want to mention about the island is that there's a stairway within the ruins that goes up to the like highest point on the island, which is like a rooftop shrine.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see all of the ruined structures from there.
Mm-hmm.
The stairway is called the Stairway to Hell.
Yeah. And it requires like special permits. Like they basically only let a very few people go out to the island at all because it's so dangerous. And you have to have a second special permit to climb the stairway to hell.
All right. So before we get into our third example here, let's pause for a second. How stoked would you guys be to go to that island?
So stoked, like the most stoked.
I would be.
Would Javier Bardem be there when
no.
we got there?
I mean, he drives the boat, but you don't.
Oh, okay.
He's not there with you. But also Chernobyl. I'm kind of fascinated
oh, yeah.
by, like, I would totally, I mean, if I could, go there.
Yeah, yeah. If I could go there relatively safely, then it would
yeah.
be. Well, I mean, Hashima Island is a little bit of a weird situation because it was... It was a death camp. I mean, it was,
right,
it was
absolutely,
a
yeah.
very, very terrible place for very many people.
But there's something, what I'm getting at here is there's something inherently compelling about these ruined structures that seem to fascinate us as human beings.
Yeah, people have been into the idea of ruins for a long time. I mean, you could see that it's not recent. It's something that, mm-hmm. you know, medieval and Renaissance people were obsessed with the ruins of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see it in the Romantic period. I think that was a big thing. The Romantic writers were really into the ruins of castles and Gothic mm-hmm. ruins.
Oh, and also when Egyptology became really popular in the Victorian era or so, it became so posh to... I mean, it has always been in certain circuits of the world very posh to go into old ruins of places and take stuff and put it in your house. But
that maybe that offends our sensibilities today because we've got our own feelings about what should be done with ruins.
We
have this current sensibility that no, ruins need to be preserved as if there was like a certain point where it's like, well, now they are in their natural state and we can't alter them from this point on when tons of stuff has happened to them already.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, some people have even been so obsessed with the idea of ruins and this kind of romantic notion of ruins that they've planned what's known as ruin value into the initial construction of buildings. Like when they're making new buildings, they say you should think about how this will look when it falls into disuse in hundreds or thousands of years. Unfortunately, one of the main names that gets associated with this idea of ruin value is Albert Speer, who was a German architect who was a Nazi in Hitler's government, you could argue to what extent this idea of ruin value is inherently associated with fascism or Nazism. But
I think one of the things that's fascinating about him that you and I were talking about earlier is that apparently none of the structures that he had planned around this philosophy of ruin value really lasted or were built because of the war.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is interesting to think about. He in this book tells this story of how, you know, he was seeing a building demolished because one building was being demolished to make room for this, I believe, Zeppelin landing field that he wanted to build. And as he saw sort of the guts of the building being torn out, he saw these steel girders and it was just like, that is hideous.
Right.
I mean, that is just awful. We should build buildings with stone, so that when they fall apart, it will be this beautiful organic falling apart rather than this ugly mangled falling apart.
So once again, we're going back to emblems of vanity and legacies of men who want to be remembered forever.
Well, it's also a cultural value judgment on the particular beauty of different objects. And
right.
I would argue that if he had existed in a postmodern artistic culture, that perhaps he would have felt differently about the beauty of steel rebar.
Sure, sure. And it might be what some people would accuse this of being, sort of the inherent Nazism of this idea of ruin value, because it's this idea that you're going to have this huge, you know, Reich that lasts forever and mm-hmm. it must be remembered as glorious.
And it must have a certain aesthetic value.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But let's not talk about Nazis too much, shall we? Let's instead talk about North Korea.
Yeah, they're far better. So the third example that we have to talk about as being a sort of modern day quote unquote ruin is the Korean DMZ, the demilitarized zone between North Korea and South Korea. So real quick, some facts. It's 155 miles long. It's 2.5 miles wide. It's basically mountainous area. And before it was the DMZ, it was populated by rice farmers who had their paddy fields out there and who were basically living there and working the land.
I mean, for like 5,000 years.
Yeah.
Like, this was a civilization for a very long time.
Yeah.
So I wonder what of that kind of settled area remains after you've removed human life from it.
Well, so it's interesting. One of the guys that we were researching who's done a lot of homework on this stuff, Alan Wiseman, actually went there and was checking it out as part of his research into what happens to civilized areas after human beings are removed from them. And the interesting thing is that it's basically gone back to being this strip of land that you can barely discern as having been populated by human beings.
And that's just in like 60 years, right?
Yeah, something like that. It's just marshland now, and that there's just been these a large push of cranes have come back into the area and repopulated the area.
Oh, you mean the birds?
Not
the machines. These white.
I think they were red-crested cranes.
Right?
Both sides would probably have major problems with actual crane, like mechanical cranes driving through the DMC.
I like how to us the mechanical cranes are the actual cranes.
Yeah. It's just these birds.
Neither of you grew up in Florida.
Stupid birds.
Well, let's look at what a couple of people have actually said about how the civilizations of today are going to decay in the future. First, I think we can just run through a quick list of all the different things you have to consider about what's going to happen to structures, because it doesn't have to be just a bomb, say, or a tornado that takes down a building. You've got things like the freezing and thawing cycle. This is something Alan Weissman, we just mentioned a second ago, and we're going to mention again in a minute, something he talks about.
That's when, due to the heating and cooling over the course of a year or a season, water will freeze and then thaw. And as we all know, one of those spectacular properties of water is that it expands when it freezes. So if it happens to be in a crack in wood or cement or anything else porous like that, it will expand, pushing the material outward. And then when it thaws and leaves the material, it leaves a crack.
It's like when you get frost heaves on the highway.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen those before?
Yeah.
And of course, that's not the only weathering you have. You have wind erosion. You have water erosion. You could have water damage from flooding and from rain.
Mm-hmm.
You could have fires. I mean, fires aren't something that's just set by a kid playing with matches. Even if an area is uninhabited, it can have fires affecting it because lightning can strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Weissman's whole thing is that after a couple of years, there'll be so much buildup of vegetation and dead leaves from the continual cycles that one lightning strike could set an entire city on fire.
Yeah. There's plant growth. That was something that we read about affecting Pripyat, Ukraine, actually, is you might not think about this often, but over time, the growth of, say, roots through the ground can displace a building
and break
it apart.
Yeah, I mean, you've probably seen this on a small scale on sidewalks when the tree's roots have grown up under a sidewalk and caused it to go all wonky.
Yeah. And the,
it's a scientific term.
Of course, you can have animal invasions, human damage of all kinds. Mm-hmm. It's not just when we leave it alone. It's also sometimes when we mess with it that things go wrong.
Oh, sure. Human damage can be from bombings or from chemical decomposition due to various stuff that we've put into the atmosphere or due to intentional vandalism.
Yeah. Well, let's go straight to Weissman now. So this guy named Alan Weissman wrote a book called The World Without Us. I think it came out in 2007.
That sounds about right. And he did an interview with, I believe it was Scientific American, where, it was like a press tour, basically promoting the book, where he talked about the basic tenets of the what he was proposing in the book. And then also he wrote a piece himself for Discover magazine that was essentially like a long abstract of the book.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And so his basic premise for the book is if all the humans on Earth just were to immediately disappear,
just vanish,
just poof and vanish, what would happen to the Earth? And a lot of what he talks about is environmental, but we wanted to focus on what he said about the structures we've created and the kind of ruins that would be left behind.
Yeah, because he really delves into those causes that you just mentioned of damage. The first one, he really looked at Manhattan very closely as a case study.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things that he noted, which I would have not known this at all, and I've been to New York a lot, is that there would immediately be water damage because there's so much water being pumped away from Manhattan because of rainfall and groundwater and local streams that if humanity was gone within like days, it would lead to flooding and underground corrosion.
I had no idea about this either.
Yeah,
he was talking about how much water is constantly pumped out of the subway system.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
It was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then his second example is the fires we were talking about earlier. So he sees that. I think his number is like 5 years. Within 5 years of humanity leaving like an urban area like Manhattan, there would be enough buildup of leaves and tall grass that if lightning hit in just the right way, it could set all the roofs of all the buildings on fire.
Oof. Wow.
And the next thing he talks about is the plant growth. So he's talking about the flora that's going to grow up in and around Manhattan that will ultimately take over and, like we were talking about before, break apart the buildings.
Mm-hmm. He actually got really specific about that,
didn't
he?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
I was curious about exactly, like, how strong can that plant invasion be?
Very strong.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, according to him, here's a direct quote. I like this. Sweet carrots would quickly devolve to their wild form. And there would be unpalatable Queen's Anne lace. The horrors. White broccoli? No, wild broccoli. Broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and cauliflower would regress to their unrecognizable broccoli ancestor.
Oh, man. This
sounds
like
so
that...
basically, it's like wild broccoli that would just be tearing buildings apart.
I feel like this should be an Attack of the Killer Tomatoes sequel like that.
That's amazing.
So what about wildlife coming in?
Yeah,
to eat all these unmentionable carrots.
He was right. He's speculating about the feral animals that would eventually show up. And if I'm remembering correctly, because I can't see it in my notes right now, I think it was that rats would be the first that would like immediately overpopulate and just cover the city, and then you would get feral dogs from the leftover pets that were left behind. This is assuming like humans just like disappear rapture style, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But that all other animals were hanging out.
Yeah, exactly. That they would all stick around. And so feral dogs would also dominate the city. He didn't mention feral cats, and I was kind of wondering about that. I wonder why. You guys have any ideas?
Cats hate Manhattan.
Is that well known. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they would all go to
go to Cat Heaven Island.
To Brooklyn.
Yeah. I think they're Connecticut animals, really.
Okay. His other thing was wolves, obviously. Would start to close in, and that there would eventually be like fights between these feral dogs and wolves.
Oh no.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the interaction, I think that some of what he was talking about here was that the interaction of all of these things, the freeze cycle and the animals and the plant life. I mean, because animals are going to eat plants and deposit seeds.
And also, like, we need to consider as well that, like, these, what we would consider from our perspective now, they would be invasive species, right? Mm-hmm. That they would be coming in and destroying these structures, just doing their daily things, such
as
making homes out of them or, like, leaving waste behind. And I can bring some knowledge from one of the episodes that I've previously written for our show Brain Stuff about raccoons, how raccoons do this in Japan. They've been destroying temples throughout Japan for the last, like, I think 30 years because there was an invasion isn't really the right word. They were imported to Japan, and there's so many raccoons there now, and they can't control the population.
Well, as pets, right?
Yeah.
They were imported as pets, and then people realized that they're terrible, creepy pets.
Well, yeah, and they imported them as pets because there was a cartoon about a raccoon that made everybody want to have a pet raccoon.
Don't have a pet raccoon, kids. Don't do it.
Go to brainstuffshow.com and you can watch me talk on video about why you shouldn't have a pet raccoon. But anyways, in the same way, all these other animals would do the same thing. They would destroy these structures over time.
You know, I'm curious. So we've talked about the different things that will be destroying the structures. And I wanted to add one more thing. If you don't believe that plant roots can destroy stone buildings, just go Google pictures of the interior of the Angkor Wat temple in Cambodia, where there are these tree roots that are moving these huge stones. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I wanted to think about what structures would remain in Manhattan. Like, so you've got all these forces acting to destroy the things humans have built. What's going to be there the longest?
Well, we talked earlier about how bridges seem to have like a bit more longevity to them than like
houses and stuff.
Houses and even buildings made out of metal and glass. That bridges would probably last for a couple of hundred years. That their bolts would stay together and they would for the most part hold up.
Although that arch based bridges would last a lot longer than, for example, suspension bridges because of the way that the same way that arches have held up in old Roman ruins for thousands of years.
It sounds generally kind of like we're saying that stone lasts longer than metal.
It does indeed. That's because stone doesn't oxidize the way that metal does, basically. I mean, there's a lot of factors involved there, but chemical decomposition of one kind or another, or chemical wearing, I think decomposition is the wrong word, has a lot to do with it. He also did talk about stone materials specifically, right?
Yeah, he mentions like examples of buildings that he thinks would outlast all of the our traditional metal and glass. He calls them glass boxes, which are essentially the kind of skyscrapery buildings like the one we're recording in right now.
Yeah,
it's a metal frame with a bunch of windows.
Yeah. Old stone buildings would last much longer. So his examples were Grand Central Station and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, obviously.
Yeah,
I could totally see that, having been to Grand Central a lot of times.
That actually sounds like a great ruin to visit in the future.
Right?
So you go on your adventure tourism trip package to ancient Manhattan, and everything else is leveled, but there you've got the Met, Grand Central Station. That sounds great.
Yeah.
With trees everywhere.
I'm sure after a couple hundred years, the food court under Grand Central would be even better than it is now.
I think that's a science fact. Yes.
One thing, though, that makes me wonder even about rocks, because, I mean, obviously physical forces can wear down anything over time, though rocks are pretty resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Weathering can, over a long, long time, knock them down, wear them down, grind them away. But what about chemical reactions?
Yeah, so this was one of the things he briefly talks about, is that, like, we've invented chemical combinations, like, for instance, pollutants or pesticides or industrial chemicals that we use for cleaning or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know how long they're going to last, but they'll probably last a long time, maybe longer than those bridges.
Yeah, and we don't necessarily know what they're going to do if they got out into the environment if they were through the water cycle or whatever, washed into modern buildings.
Plastic, too. That's another one. And his point is that, like, most of these things didn't even exist before World War II.
Right,
like, we invented them all after that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So, fun, exciting things to discover.
Maybe those are the ruined legacies that we'll have in the future, is like milk bottles.
So Weissman had a timeline. We've already mentioned quite a few things in it where he sort of predicted after X number of years this would happen, but... there were a few things I think we didn't get to yet. What are they?
We talked about how the subway system would flood. He says that would happen within 2 days.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you believe that?
Okay.
And then after a year, all the street pavement would split and buckle because of the freeze effect that we talked about, the thawing. Within 2 to 4 years, all those streets would be filled with weeds because there would be plant life growing up out of them, which would subsequently turn into trees, which would upheave the sidewalks and the streets even more and damage the sewers.
Yeah, and it's after 4 years that thing we mentioned earlier, the freeze-thaw cycle, he predicts after 4 years that would really cause buildings to begin to crumble, because we don't often think about heat as benefiting the building itself. It just benefits us, but it actually can benefit the building.
Oh, absolutely.
It can help protect the building from the freeze-thawing cycle it would naturally undergo.
Well, also certainly anything like water pipes. This is a thing that all of us probably have a little bit of experience with in the winter. If you let water freeze in a pipe and then it will burst, that's good times.
Yep. Oh, that reminds me. I should have probably
left
my tap on today.
Mm.
Oh, well. Well, we'll see what happens when I get home. For those of you out there, this is one of the few days of the years in Atlanta where we get below freezing. So also then 5 years. There's a little bit of dispute here between these. Like, these are arbitrary dates, and I don't think that Weissman has like a crystal ball that he's looking into and he knows exactly what they are.
Well, I wouldn't call them arbitrary, but they're speculation.
They're clever speculation.
He's done his research, but there's a dispute among other people who've researched this.
Educated guesses.
So, for instance, he says within 5 years there would be enough growth that a lightning strike could set the city on fire. Other people say like 50 years. I don't know. 5 years sounds reasonable to me, actually.
Yeah, I don't know.
It all depends on the location of the strike.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, you have to take into consideration that Manhattan is not like Tampa, and so there's a relative small amount of thunderstorms there. But still, yeah, absolutely.
after about 100 years, he says that the roofs of nearly all houses are going to be caved in.
Yeah.
And of course, that makes it worse for the frame of the house itself.
Right.
Then at 300, that's when we start losing suspension bridges. The arch bridges last a little bit longer. And then he jumps. He goes from 300 to 15,000 plus years. That's when the stone buildings, like what we were talking about with Grand Central, those buildings would start to fall because advancing glaciers would close in on New York and the Ice Age would begin.
That's a good thing to point out because one of the things we haven't thought all that much about is climate change. So not just the effects of weather temporarily, but as the climate, the long-term climate of the area actually shifts. And if you've got New York turning into a more, you know, Ice Age Arctic kind of environment and you've got glaciers pushing things down, obviously that's going to destroy a bunch of ruins. I mean, it might leave nothing left.
Yeah. And now we've talked about how the theory is that traditional metal and glass buildings reinforced with concrete are not necessarily going to last very long. But he speculates that there is one kind of metal that's going to be around for almost 10 million years.
Yeah.
And that's bronze, particularly bronze sculptures.
It surprised me, but it made me want to look up, well, okay, if bronze is going to be around for 10 million years and actually retain its shape, as he says, what are some of the coolest and biggest bronze statues in the world that we will still have that far in the future? One I found is the African Renaissance Monument. This looked interesting to me. It's a 160-foot or 49-meter bronze statue in Dakar, Senegal. And the monument was inaugurated in 2010 and designed by a North Korean firm called the Mansudae Art Studio. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, it looks kind of like that Soviet realism sculpture. It's got this very, like, strong, powerful-looking man peering ahead into the future and holding a baby up in the air and holding a woman on his other arm. And, like, they're pointing up into the future and the woman is pointing back into the past. And it's sort of this thing suggesting a change in eras, I think. It's
so
kind of beautiful and also kind of propagandistic at the same time.
Yeah, so what we're kind of saying here is if you want your legacy to last for at least 10 million years, that, you know, have a bronze statue built of you.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's probably not that expensive.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So it makes me think we may have 10 million years yet for the Bronze Horseman of St. Petersburg, Russia.
Right. That's your next one, right?
Yeah. That was on for a couple of reasons, actually. Its base is the Thunderstone, which, as far as I know, is still the biggest stone that humans have ever moved.
Wow. Okay.
And then, of course, on top, it's got a bronze horse and a rider. Also, we're going to have the bronze fawns for a long time. Y'all ever seen the bronze fawns?
No.
No.
Look this up. It's in Milwaukee. It's the fawns. Hey, it's bronze. It's a monument to culture.
So, okay, note to self. I either have to have enough money to build a bronze statue of myself or be as famous as Henry Winkler.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, one or the other.
I can work
on that.
Get
to work on it. Yeah.
You know,
I'm already starting here.
I'm kind of sad that, so we have a bronze fawns, but we don't have bronze statues to the characters Henry Winkler plays in Arrested Development or in Scream. You remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like to think of the bronze fawns as encapsulating all of them.
That's probably how they meant it.
Yeah.
Well, in addition to Alan Weissman's speculation, there was some more well-researched speculation from somebody named Bob Holmes, who wrote an article for New Scientist in 2006 about what would happen if humans disappeared from Earth. Now, of course, we're not imagining humans are going to disappear from Earth, but that's just a good scenario in which to say what would happen to these buildings if they fell into disuse.
We are imagining it. We're not predicting it.
So the interesting thing about Holmes' research is that a lot of it overlaps with Weissman's.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a couple things in this article that he adds that I think provide some details that weren't necessarily in Weissman's. For instance, I didn't know this, but he says that modern buildings, such as the one that we're in right now, are typically engineered to only last for 60 years.
Oof.
That is not much time.
Bridges are only designed to last for 120 years nowadays and dams for 250.
And is that assuming that people are taking care of these structures for that entire time, but that after that they'll just kind of like shiver and fall apart?
No, I should make the distinction here that he's not talking about buildings that are receiving constant maintenance.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. that's more comforting.
Think about how many modern buildings just in metropolitan Atlanta that are around that have been abandoned for one reason or another that are probably closing in on 60 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. But of course, that is talking about these modern buildings. He also points out, like Weissman, that the ones that are made of stone or concrete are going to be around a lot longer. Like
yep.
they could last thousands of years.
Yeah.
And so I think that we're beginning to form a good picture for the kind of thing we would see in the future. I'd imagine that the future ruins tourist would see lots of strangely punctuated sites, because the way cities are laid out now, you might mm-hmm. have an area that has a lot of solid stone buildings, and then the next block might have, you know, these modern buildings.
Right.
And the next block might have houses, you know, for which there's just no trace left at all. They're mm-hmm. wood mm-hmm. or brick houses where the roofs will cave in and the frame will eventually collapse, like we've read about here. I'm trying to picture it, and I'm imagining, like Manhattan, for example, the one we've been talking about, kind of a flat landscape where many of these buildings are just gone and there's nothing. And then suddenly there are these huge, huge, tall stone monuments mm-hmm. left.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There is research being done into the long-time survivability of the kind of things that we're building with today, and how those structures are going to be impacted by weather disuse or any other number of things. And it kind of comes down to the quality of the building, which, I mean, it sounds obvious when you say it out loud, but for example, we put steel bones basically in our concrete buildings because it's a kind of quick and easy way, relatively inexpensive way to prop up all of this concrete. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that if you don't measure and pour and seal everything extremely precisely, when carbon steel is in contact with air, and particularly humid air, which is basically air, it oxidizes. It will begin to rust and begin to warp and bend. It's also more susceptible to heat and cold. And by susceptible, I mean that it shrinks and expands more than the concrete surrounding it, which can lead to cracks in the concrete and spalling, which is an industry term for like flaking
mm-hmm.
of that kind
a great
of material.
Term.
Spalling,
mm-hmm.
I know, right?
Quit your spalling.
Your face is spalling.
Wow. That's harsh. That's the second old joke you guys have made at me. It's my first time on the show.
It wasn't at you. That was at the room in general.
Oh.
That's up there with Nanorod, I think, for me, in terms of great insults that we've come up with here on Forward Thinking. You Nanorod.
Have you never heard us say that?
I mean, I haven't heard you say it, but it sounds bad. Sounds.
We'll talk about nanorods later.
Sounds kind of immature, frankly.
Well, the other question that arises when we're thinking about the effects of our human processes on what would be modern ruins is the question of pollution. Because especially back in the 80s, we heard so much about acid rain, and we still worry on a sort of civilization scale about what the pollution that we're creating is going to do to all of these structures now and into the future. And the thing is that we don't really know. Yay. I mean, because there's a lot of natural chemical weathering that happens. You know, the thing is that atoms and compounds do not usually stay the way that we leave them. All kinds of things happen. Water reacts chemically with basically everything. It's called the universal solvent for a reason. And it's also a really good physical carrier of stuff. And what stuff am I talking about? Both natural and man-made dust in the atmosphere made of all kinds of chemicals, bacteria and other microfauna and flora, seeds, and anything it runs across on the ground, you know, from natural deposits of salt, which is a very corrosive material, to whatever minerals or bits and pieces of weird trash that we've left around. So it depends is basically the answer.
Yeah, and I would assume, too, based on that, this is a complete assumption, not based on research whatsoever, but that cities that are built by the ocean or the sea are going to be more likely to corrode faster because of the amount of salt content that's
I think.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
There's definitely, you can see on the outer walls of Hashima, the salt erosion that has happened to the buildings versus the interior walls.
Yeah.
So this makes me wonder, now that we've sort of imagined this future city as it lies in ruins, how long will it take for even those ruins to disappear? Like, have any of these writers speculated on at what point we will see pretty much nothing left?
So Holmes' thing is he says that it would take a few tens of thousands of years, so that's pretty vague, at most, before every trace of human existence is wiped out.
Oh, wow.
And his thing is that if alien visitors came here in 100,000 years, they would have no obvious signs that we had ever been here.
Now, I imagine, though, that would be talking about on the surface, right? Like, they could still dig and excavate.
There were parts of it where he talked about that, of course, like, for instance, the pesticides that we were mentioning earlier that may, in fact, last forever, that they would be able to dig that stuff up.
Right.
And
so,
they would find a trace of culture and civilization.
Yeah, maybe a bronze statue in a milk bottle or something like that. Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, the bronze statue is going to last for 10 million years.
Yeah.
So,
but it'd probably be buried.
Exactly.
But it would be under the Great Wall. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to talk about one last thing, and it's, is that thing in Planet of the Apes going to happen to the Statue of Liberty?
Well, you know, I don't know. It's highly unlikely, given the beach topography that we saw in the first Planet of the Apes, that that's exactly what would happen to it.
I was like, what is this? That does not look like the New York Harbor.
Yeah,
unless maybe the Statue of Liberty floated somewhere.
Maybe the apes dragged it as a trophy to a different area.
Yeah.
No, I do actually want to have one final thought here at the end, which is the question of, can cities of the past disappear into the cities of the present or the future? Because we've been talking about ruins a lot of times in the context of cities and areas being left behind. People either move away, or even in these hypothetical scenarios, we just imagine if people disappeared, more realistically, people, you know, just migrate to a different area.
Right.
But a lot of times people continuously inhabit the same areas. You can actually look up, there's a Wikipedia page that's a list of oldest continually inhabited cities.
Oh, really?
So it's just this huge list of settlements that have had people in them for thousands of years continuously.
Right, and like human beings, they're just shedding flakes, basically, and regenerating over the years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But by constantly inhabiting a single location for hundreds or thousands of years, and you're always making repairs, refurbishing, updating, maintaining buildings, and often tearing down old buildings to make space for new ones, are you effectively erasing the static remnants of older versions of the city?
Like, right.
The better we get at maintaining civic infrastructure, the better we get at keeping our cities nice and clean and well-repaired and up-to-date, are we actually keeping less remains of the older versions of the civilization? I mean, apart from whatever you intentionally preserve in an archaic state.
Sure, right. Yeah, I mean, and obviously this taps into the idea of urban renewal, which I think is like a totally different topic that we can't tackle right now. Mm-hmm. But the city of Atlanta, where we're at right now, is a fascinating example of what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely.
In that there is a constant not only restructuring of neighborhoods, but also of just the buildings themselves. Think of, for instance, our new home for How Stuff Works is going to be in a building called Pont City Market, which was once an old Sears and Roebuck building.
Distribution center, yeah. And then for a number of years, it was a branch of City Hall.
Right.
And then it sat dormant for a bit.
A long time, yeah.
And now it's being renewed into loft and office space.
Yeah, one of the coolest things about this city, I think, is like that renewal, the restoration of old properties.
A lot of my favorite restaurants are built with like the original brick, you know, and they used to be auto garages or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But of course, when that building needs repairs because it's still got a restaurant in it, you might have to replace this wall.
Mm-hmm.
Or this pillar, or at some point, maybe even knock it down. It's just in too bad a state. And of course, it's good property. You know, there were businesses there. So somebody's going to build something on top of it. it's sort of, I imagined it like this. It's the difference between doing multiple drafts of a document on a typewriter, mm-hmm. where you've got saved copies at each stage. You could think of that as equivalent to, you know, building a civilization and then moving away, versus keeping a document updated in a digital format. Like you've got a Word document, and every time you revise it, you make changes, you edit, and then you save over what you had before, sort of erasing the evidence of the previous drafts.
Yeah, I think your metaphor would work perfectly with paper and pencil, right? If you had written a document on a single sheet of paper and then you wanted to change something about that document, you erased over it and then you wrote over that part that you erased, but there would still be slight remnants of the original writing.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder which physical civilization disappears faster and more completely. Is it the one that's been abandoned to the elements of the earth and to weathering and all those things we talked about earlier? Or is it the one that's constantly being saved over?
Mm.
Like, which city is maintained farther into the future? The one we keep living in or the one that we leave behind to nature?
From what we've seen of the three examples we talked about, the island off the coast of Japan, the Chernobyl area, and then the DMZ zone, I mean, I guess I would say that it's those areas that are abandoned because those have only been... Which one of those is the oldest since there's been human population there?
Yeah.
And the DMZ is the one that, as far as, you know, Weissman says, you can barely tell that human beings lived and worked there.
Well, it was also less structured. I mean,
They didn't have, like, metal tall buildings the way that the island did.
Yeah.
Right. Hashima was actually the site of some of the first concrete skyscrapers that were ever built. Mm. So
maybe a better thing to look at would be the difference between ancient cities with stone buildings that were abandoned versus ancient cities with stone buildings that have been continuously inhabited.
Sure.
I don't know which the answer is, but if you're listening and you have an opinion on this, why don't you write in and let us know?
Yeah, there's a few ways that you can get in touch with us. You can email us at fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Google+, where our handle is FWThinking. You can go to our website, which is fwthinking.com, in order to find many podcasts and videos of your potential interest. But before we sign off here, let's give one big last warm thank you to Christian for joining us on this adventure.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
We've loved having you on the show, man.
I hope that I can live up to Jonathan Strickland's the gravitas.
I think you have. At the very least, you've brought the baritone voice that we needed into the podcast room. where can everyone find your work?
Mainly on brainstuffshow.com, although I'm more recently writing for our How Stuff Works YouTube channel for the show What the Stuff that we do that Lauren performs on, and both Lauren and Joe help write with as well.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us, and thanks again for listening. We will talk to you all again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.